Cooking for Politics podcast is brought to you by Global Pulse Media, which has partnered with Hivecast FM, a firm that assembles a creative and professional team that takes podcasts such as Cooking for Politics to the next level. This team handles all audio and video editing services. So for a nominal fee, you will get a personal account manager that helps take the headache out of editing and just leave podcasters like myself focus on just creating good content for their audiences. So if you're a podcaster listening and need help editing, feel free to reach out to me. I can be reached at cuckoo4politics@gmail.com. I could not have succeeded without this talented team at Hivecast FM. This is Michael, host of the political podcast, Cuckoo for Politics. I am so passionate about politics, hence the name Cuckoo for Politics, and I hope you are too. Thanks for joining. This is a podcast discussion on political perspectives on various issues that matter with citizens of the world. So I do ask that you grab your favorite libations, whether it be coffee, tea, water, juice, beer, wine, or a spirit or two, and let's get ready for some lively conversation and let's learn something together. In the United States, a district attorney is the chief prosecutor or chief law enforcement officer representing a state and local government, typically a county or a group of counties. Their role is to investigate, evaluate, and prosecute criminal violations committed within their jurisdiction. They are also involved in community policing, law enforcement training, and task force operations. Furthermore, they provide legal assistance to criminal investigations conducted by local law enforcement agencies. In practice, that person who holds that office prosecutes the bulk of criminal cases, along with their assistants, better known as ADAs, which stands for Assistant District Attorneys, and they answer to no one. Now, Monroe County, Pennsylvania, better known to the wider audience as the Poconos, is a fast and upcoming county in terms of overall population due to the affordability of housing and the cost of goods and services in comparison to nearby states of New York and New Jersey. The area not only attracts people to enjoy a certain lifestyle, but attracts people from all over to vacation, as the Poconos offers a wide variety of indoor and outdoor activities for all ages and for every season. But like all communities throughout our country, comes with its own set of problems, such as crime and other public safety concerns. The Office of District Attorney is very influential, as it sets the tone of how cases will be prosecuted and what types of cases he or she will pursue on behalf of the public's interest. Now, although this episode will focus on getting to know a particular candidate, it will also provide you, the listener, a member of the voting public who may live in a small region like the Poconos or a large one like the city of New York or Philadelphia, as the issues mentioned in this segment will apply to wherever you live in America. Joining me in a discussion on why he wants to be the next district attorney is First Assistant District Attorney Michael Mancuso. He currently holds a position since 2004. Prior, he was a first public defender. He has tried over 50 murder trials, prosecuted hundreds of violent crimes, including police officers who have broken the law. He has earned his degree from Dickinson Law School of Law and has admitted to practice before the U.S. Supreme Court. He continues to teach and mentor attorneys on the practices and skills needed in and outside the courtroom, all in the name of justice. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Cuckoo for Politics. Let's get ready for some lively discussion while learning something together. What's up, good people? Thank you again for listening and subscribing to the podcast. Now, to those who have been following this podcast series, I indicated my last episode, I'll be sitting down with a minister to talk candidly about religion, and politics, how some things should not mix? Anyway, that is a discussion to be had and will be a forthcoming episode. So stay tuned for that one. However, this episode premieres during the fall election, and I wanted to take the time to speak with a candidate who's running in a local election. So, if you recall, in episode 42, titled Why, Mr. District Attorney, I interviewed a candidate by the name of Don Leith. Now, he, along with Mike Mancuso, ran for the Democratic nomination during the primary elections early this spring. However, Don was unsuccessful and Mike won. Now, there were no challenges in elections as results were clear. So, in a republic, get this, the voting public gets to choose their leaders by the power of the vote. Whoever has the most votes wins. Simple, right? The people decided by their vote who they wish to represent their best interest. That's it. A candidate who loses an election bows out graciously and supports the victor. Simple, right? That's it. Now, I know there's an emotional toll for a candidate that loses, but he or she accepts the will of the people. Now, I only say that because you remember back in the 2020 election cycle, a candidate lost their bid to hold public office, and instead of stepping aside graciously and supporting the winner of the elections, they instead spread false election narratives and incited an insurrection on the government. Now, see, that didn't happen in this primary election. Attorney Don Leith lost in the primary, and his immediate response, especially in various public settings, was to throw his support behind the victor, Mr. Mancuso. See, candidates like Don Leith demonstrate integrity, maturity, and above all, respect the will of the people. That's what we do in a democracy. Sorry, I was digressing because these are becoming strange political times, and personally, I have grave concerns for next year's elections. But anyway, let's get started with my conversation with Mike Mancuso. Mike, welcome to the podcast, and congratulations on election win. Before we get into the meat and potatoes of our conversation, briefly describe a little background of yourself for the wider audience.
Yeah, we don't want to get too detailed, Michael, but thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate this opportunity. My full name is Michael Mancuso. I have no middle name. My parents, for some reason, never settled upon one. I'm currently 57 years old. I live in Chestnut Hill Township, Monroe County, Pennsylvania, with my wife, Colleen. I have four children. One is still at home. He'll be a senior this year at Pleasant Valley High School. My daughter, the next in line, she just left a couple weeks ago to go to university in Temple in Philadelphia. I grew up in the Poconos, but like many of us, I am a transplant. I arrived here at the age of 13, going on 14, from New Jersey, where I was born and raised up until that point. I was born in Newark, New Jersey, and I lived in Belleville, as well as Bloomfield in New Jersey. My parents were Richard and Teresa Mancuso, both of whom passed away. My father was a cook and a restaurateur for most of his life. He opened several different businesses over the course of his career in the food industry, and I learned a lot from him in that regard. My mother was a homemaker for a while, but went back to school, and eventually, after the kids had grown up, had actually gotten a college degree, and she was very proud of that. I played football in high school at Pocono Mountain. I was also into boxing. I did construction work. There was a point in time where I didn't want to go to college, but I did. And after I got that degree, I wanted to work in a trade. But there was a point in time when my grandfather convinced me to take the law school entrance exam. And just coincidentally, a good friend of mine, Ali Daimi, who is Iranian by birth, was taking that same law school entry test down in Fairleigh Dickinson, New Jersey. And he just called me out of the blue and said, hey, why don't you come take this with me? And I did. And I got into law school and I did pretty well there. I did my first year in Mississippi College School of Law in Jackson. My first wife, Melissa, at the time was a military police lieutenant stationed in Fort Polk, Louisiana, so I was close by. After 1 year in law school down in Mississippi, I transferred to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and completed my second 2 years in Dickinson School of Law. And after that, I got a job in Stroudsburg, more by chance than anything else. I applied all over the state, and that was with a law firm called then at the time Robinson, Hoffner & Billick. And I was there for a short time doing insurance defense and civil work, but I also took a couple court-appointed cases, most notably in my memory, representing parents in an action brought by Children and Youth Services to terminate parental rights. Those are called dependency actions. And in the course of a hearing, I believe in front of Judge Peter O'Brien, there was a public defender at the time, Mark Newman, who saw me and approached me afterwards and said, I really should think about applying for a job in the public defender's office. And there was an opening there. So I was hired as a public defender, and I worked there full-time for 5 years, and then I was part-time as a public defender for another two, and I handled all sorts of cases and learned the trade of a criminal defense attorney. And from there, I had opened a private practice, and I also was hired as a part-time assistant district attorney, which I did for 16 years as part-time, but I did become first assistant district attorney in 2004 and held that position while practicing civil law up until 2016. And then the caseload was so great and so hard to keep up, especially because I was doing the lion's share of the most difficult cases, the most serious trials, mostly all murder cases, that I was made full-time as a first assistant DA in, like, again, 2016, and I haven't looked back since. I think that's about the highlights of my career. I can get in more detail, Mike, if you'd like to.
Thanks for sharing your brief bio and your journey towards law. As you made references that you have been the first assistant district attorney since 2004, in that role, you have handled a bulk of cases thrown your way. If you can, describe what has been the most problematic or reoccurring themes or issues during your tenure facing this county?
Well, the interplay between drug addiction, mental health, and domestic violence, those three big issues contribute a lot to repeat offenses, recidivism, you know, that revolving door analogy. You know, we've heard a lot about reoffending or violating parole or probation, going back to jail, back out. We see that with domestic violence, and a lot of my murder cases have involved domestic violence. And you could see that cycle and how things go from bad to worse. Studies have shown that a victim in a domestic of a non-fatal strangulation is 800 times more likely to die as a result of a homicide than anyone else just walking down the street. And that's a real troubling thing. And I know stats like that led to the beefing up of some of the laws involving domestic violence, the creation of the crime of strangulation, which, you know, could be a felony, all in an effort to try to stop that. So when I began my full-time tenure as first assistant, and these patterns came up, and many times too, Mike, they were generational. You know, you see families repeating the crimes of their parents and et cetera. So there's got to be a way to break these cycles. So I've been trying a bunch of different initiatives that I'm proud of, and I think will be worthy of success. One of the ones to deal with this problem of domestic violence would be, and I met with counselor at the correctional facility, Ms. Leah Baylor. I think this is a good program. It's called the Batterers Intervention Program. And Yvonne Downs, our victim advocate, tells me that there is statistics that back up the success of this program in helping break the cycle of domestic violence. So what often happens, and this is a frustration of all prosecutors in a domestic case, we know the victim was injured, we know the victim was threatened, yet the victim will go to extra lengths to try to not testify, not cooperate, insist that the charges be dropped. And you could see in someone's record, for instance, a lot of that in these types of cases. You have police calls. If they don't want to go forward with the charges, then maybe nothing comes of it. But then if there are charges filed, then you'll see those charges withdrawn. Defense attorneys can and sometimes do take advantage of that mindset by making overtures to the victim, talking about you know, the effect of incarceration and what it could do to the family and the employment status, and kind of guilting the victim into dropping charges. So there's got to be a better way for a lot of these cases. So this Batterers Intervention Program, I'm told, is a nice, in-depth, lengthy sort of deep dive into what triggers violence on a part of these folks.
You hit it on a point as far as being generational. I know my parents, I grew up in a home like that where my father was abusive to my mom. And watching that as a child, I knew I did not want to do that. I knew it was the wrong thing. And just to be clear, my father did a certain period of time because his father did that to his mom. So you're right on point. And it was an intervention in a sense when my father became saved, as far as becoming a Christian, he, you know, changed his ways and so forth. But it is programs like that are definitely vital. And it, depending on the child, luckily, I was very fortunate to see that I knew that was wrong, and I had other supporting family members knowing that that was not the way you should treat a woman in any type of relationship. So I'm glad that there are programs like that, and it's unfortunately it's still needed today. And you said that was probably the most problematic situations you find in a county per se.
Well, that and the interplay with mental health and drug addiction. But with the batterer's intervention, and I'm glad that you saw your father's abuse as a negative and not something that you thought was something you would ever consider doing. And there's many people like that, Mike, that don't follow in their father's footsteps. But there's just as many that do. And I'm not sure what the deciding factor is. I'd love to know.
This is a public service announcement. I briefly interrupt this flow of the conversation because this issue is dear to me. If you are a victim of domestic violence, please call the 24/7 National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233 or text at 88788. Now back to the conversation. Now, do you find, you said, you know, since there's been an increase with that, do you find that the police officers who are called into that situations, are they being properly trained or given the tools? Are there someone that goes with them that is like that knows how to address domestic violence?
Well, domestic violence calls themselves are among the most dangerous for law enforcement. So it wouldn't make sense at that earliest stage to bring in someone who might be more trained in the social services to provide like counseling at that point. But having said that, the officers now are among the best trained to deal with that initial assessment. And we've devised and promulgated a domestic violence protocol for the county that includes the dissemination of information promptly and clearly to victims, outlining resources available to them, their rights, and contact information. So that is done now, and it's supposed to be done uniformly, and we have trainings about that. And we had just revised the protocol last year, and I was very proud of that. And it'll require ongoing training. But the point I was making about the batterers program is when you have that initial arrest and you have a subject, a defendant incarcerated pretrial, right now in the county, there's no facility for a batterers intervention program for an inmate. There's a very rudimentary program called the batterers assessment. But Ms. Baylor convinced me that we should be pushing for batterers intervention. So we're going to be reaching out to the county authorities and the warden in order to secure the logistical support for that program. And she's lining up the counselors that that would actually administer the intervention. So I'm very happy about that. And that's never been done before, but it would give a nice pause to the couple, because on the one hand, my office could make it clear to the victims, hey, this is not something we're looking to put this man away for years on end. But if he gets into this program now and he completes it in 3-4 months, and he does what's expected of him, you know, we're going to feel a lot better. You're going to feel a lot better. And he's going to feel a lot better about him not reoffending. And then we can talk about a nice resolution that'll ensure that you guys could stay together if that's what you want to do. But we don't want you to feel pressured. We don't want to feel like there's only one way, and that's dropping the charges outright. Years ago, we used to have a victimless protocol for those types of cases. And that was good and bad. It was good because it would hold people accountable if you could prove the case without the direct involvement of the victim. But it was also bad on the victim if you had to drag her into court and get her on the stand and start questioning her. And then if she started to change her story, try to cross-examine her on prior statements or show her the photographs of her all bruised and beaten. And it served to increase the trauma. So this way, I'm hoping will be a way that would be less harmful on the victim's emotion and trauma, but also get to that cycle of repetitive violence.
Now, as district attorney, you're working hand in hand with the police on these cases. Now, do you find that, as you said, they're being more trained, they're being more exposed to handle various degrees of crises? My question to you is in this twofold. I feel like more and more societal woes are being placed on the burden of the police to resolve, or like there's so much they can handle. And I see like there's now a decrease in amount of applicants going into policing. Do you think it's because we put so much, like the municipalities put so much burden on the police to handle everything?
I think that's a major factor, Mike, in the decline of enthusiasm of the general public to become police officers. We see that statewide. Apparently, it's also nationwide. And of course, we feel its effects within Monroe County. Enrollment in police academies is down. Every police department within Monroe County is understaffed right now with officers. I know the requirements to, for instance, to enter the state police academy have also been lowered. Lowered to the point where a college degree is not required right now.
Now, that's a concern, not having a college degree. There's a sense of maturity that comes with higher education. Now, if we're lowering our standards, what can you expect from the applicants? And why wouldn't the state or the county provide incentives similar to what the military does or the airlines do when they need to fill a void? They provide tuition reimbursement, because you don't want, I would hate to have a high schooler as my police officer when I, the citizen, is more mature and more experienced than this high school kid is telling me to pull over. Do you follow where my thought pattern is?
Oh yeah, that is the concern. And you're right, there is a greater maturity that you would expect with someone who's completed a college degree, showed up, took the tests, got the degree, a steadiness younger people may or may not have. I'm not saying that everyone with just a high school degree would not be able to do that, but it's asking a lot. It's a lot of discretion and power and authority that police officers are given. And as you lower the standards, you get into problems with character flaws and people that slip through the cracks. Several years ago, the state police had removed the requirement of a polygraph examination for applicants as part of the screening process. And that was an effort to attract more candidates, also to attract more minority cadets into the academy, because there's an ongoing push for that throughout the state.
Wait. You're telling me policymakers thought by lowering the standards, including removing the requirement for applicants to take a polygraph, its intention was to attract more women and persons of color to join the police force? What does that mean? What is that insinuating? For some reason, I feel that is an insult versus a plus. Maybe I'm lost. I don't understand. Is that policy still in effect?
But by doing that, there were people really that shouldn't have been considered getting into the state police. And it wasn't too long before that policy was reversed, so that background checks now do include polygraphs and also psychiatric and psychological evaluations.
I see a problem that could come from lowering our standards, not just what I just mentioned, but then you may be, I'll say it in this fold, you're trying to get good applicants. You're trying to diversify the workforce. Part of the problem too, and I'll just say this in this particular area in Monroe County, is the cost of living. With cost of living increasing everywhere, the salaries, the incentives needs to be there as well, would you say, in order to create that, to attract quality applicants to join the police force?
Absolutely. Without that incentive, and because of the high demand all over, applicants are going to go where they're the best paid or the cost of living is the lowest, and they could make the best life for themselves.
Now, Mike, as a career first assistant district attorney, you have developed good working relationships with members of the law enforcement community. You have probably witnessed firsthand some of the brave actions done by these individuals who put their lives at risk. The public, for the most part, see these same brave actions done as well, especially when they're highlighted in the news or in social media feeds. We, the public, applaud and support them. However, we cannot deny that there are those who abuse their oath to protect and to serve. What do you plan to implement, as you will presumably be the next district attorney?
Well, one thing to prelude that answer, I have to say that in the course of my career, I have learned the utmost respect for the vast majority of the officers that I've worked with. I'm telling you, there's a selflessness, a fearlessness in the face of danger, a lack of hesitation to go where others would fear to go, whether it's a burning house or it's a fresh crime scene with suspects unaccounted for. I mean, there's no hesitation. So you're right. The majority of men and women who go into law enforcement have that desire to serve and protect. And I've seen it over and over again. But you're right also that those few who screw that up, who tarnish the badge, who breach the confidence of the public and their trust, does stain the entirety of police, of law enforcement. And we see it too with dirty prosecutors and dirty judges. It gives the entire system a bad look. So looking at what's expected of law enforcement, looking at the dwindling resources that have been dwindling, for instance, in the mental health field since the mid-1970s with the closure of state institutions and resources, more and more then that burden's been shouldered by law enforcement. And it hasn't been fair, and it's required many, many hats to be worn by officers. And at the onset, with very, very little training that would even justify the wearing of those hats. So by necessity, they're taking on roles that traditionally were not law enforcement roles. So having said that as a prelude, there were initiatives that I've implemented within the course of the last 3 or 4 years that kind of set the table for what's going to follow. One of them is the Law Enforcement Treatment Initiative, the LETI program, which officially recognizes and empowers law enforcement to divert the low-level crimes where there's an addiction component away from the criminal justice system directly into treatment, partnering with Carbon Monroe Pike, drug and alcohol, for instance. We can get people in treatment best suited for them based upon an evaluation by qualified drug and alcohol counselors. And if that's completed, then there won't be any charges, or charges will be withdrawn. And it'll hopefully, over the course of time, reduce crime rates and reduce that revolving door. In addition to that, there is currently in effect in Monroe County a very intense study going on to combat gun violence, which is a very broad term. So it encompasses any kind of criminal action committed with a firearm or for the purpose of securing a firearm. So even straw purchases, even burglaries of firearms to support a drug habit, for instance. And of course, any crime of violence committed with a firearm. So this gun violence study is the result of a grant I was able to secure with the help of some very dedicated people in the county system who helped me write the grant. And now there's a professional group who's undertaking this deep dive into the nooks and crannies of Monroe County. So all the different communities and there's questionnaires that have almost reached the point of going out now. There will be town halls, all kinds of data has been already collected with more to follow. And it's our hope that we get a look into what areas of the county need help or different types of focus to reduce this threat of gun violence, which again ties into the drug culture, ties into mental health concerns, ties into domestic violence. We've broken it down into key areas: a government group, law enforcement group, a community group, all giving the CARI group their individual focus with a hopefully all-encompassing take by them. And it'll be a report, and it's a model in the state right now. The Pennsylvania Commission on Crime and Delinquency is very excited about this. It hasn't been done yet in Pennsylvania. So everybody's waiting now. What's going to come of it, and what can we do as a result of it? So I'm very happy about that. That's a work in progress.
Thank you for the explanation and explaining the importance of the LETI program, whereby police officers will help individuals suffering from drug addiction in placing them in drug treatment programs versus quickly processing these same individuals straight into the criminal justice system. However, I will ask my question in a different way. What is your plan to ensure transparency between members of the law enforcement and the community when the public trust has been broken, especially cases involving persons of color? It's important to have accountability when a wrong has been done and the evidence overwhelmingly find that the police were found to be guilty of their dereliction of duty. Do you follow?
Well, the regaining of trust, particularly by minority members of the Monroe County community, is very, very important to me. It's very, very important also to the police chiefs that I deal with on a regular basis. So right now, one of the ways to do that is in implementation. So the use of body cameras by officers is becoming standard now for all our local police departments. And that's a good step forward because like I tell them, it can only protect you as well from false allegations of discriminatory intent. I'm a proponent of it, and I've been a proponent of body cameras for years, and I'm happy to say that our local regional departments are getting them. Pocono Township already has them, and the Pennsylvania State Police pilot programs concluded, and they're in the process of getting them. Initially, a lot of the hesitation was due to financial concerns. See, the county doesn't fund our police departments, with the exception of the district attorney's detective or investigation division. Each municipality could fund it, like Pocono Township funds their own. Pocono Mountain Regional is a regional through memorandum of understanding, the creation of a regional police agency and a funding formula, and the same with Stroud Area Regional. Plus, those regional police departments are also unionized. So oftentimes there's collective bargaining and arbitration that helps set salaries and make things more competitive so we can attract, the best officers. So once the body camera thing to me is a seminal requirement for transparency, the next is the data. It's all in my mind about where the data is. I'm very fact specific. And if the data tells me that there is disparate treatment, then we have to inquire to the cause. And if the cause is a discriminatory intent, then of course we need to combat that. We need to stop it. And so that's ongoing. So what do you do with the data? Well, right now the data is in kind of a hodgepodge state. It's kind of deplorable in terms of the ease of collecting it and analyzing it. It's all kind of primitive. I'm told that the county system for data collection for criminal cases is going to be upgraded, and that may help ease some of this. But I am a proponent of a group called Measures for Justice, which will actually help us with the data collection and analysis. But the quid pro quo of that is all of that data is then made available to the public, absent privacy rights, social security numbers, what have you. And that's a good thing because that's going to really aid in transparency. But most people are apathetic in the community. Most people don't know the role of the district attorney and how much a district attorney can interfere with police procedures in a given department. But certainly the district attorney has a megaphone and can bring attention to things. So another part of accountability would be the creation of an advisory board for the district attorney, which gives a very well-balanced composition based on the latest census records for the county. And the formation of this would be individuals, not groups. So say, for instance, Mike, you're asked to be part of the advisory board. You would be there in your individual capacity, bringing your knowledge of life, your educational background, your common sense into the mix as an individual. And the whole idea would be to help create initiatives in part to engage with the community to create that trust, to get more people involved and to change the perception so that that new perception becomes the reality, with increasing cooperation between the community and the law enforcement, individuals, people in the know within the community setting, providing guidance, kind of a helpful do's and don'ts, and hopefully can also lead to the greater recruitment of a more diverse police force that would capture the actual composition of the county.
So you're saying that that is not done now with a like type of I guess it's a volunteer program where the district attorney sits down with a panel of the community leaders?
No, it's really not. It's not anywhere that I've seen in the state. A good friend of mine, Sonny Murray, former U.S. attorney, was telling me he thought it would be groundbreaking and a great idea. Sonny was a founding member of the NAACP chapter here in Monroe County in the 70s, and I trust his judgment on that. And when I proposed that as an idea, he was very, very excited about it. So we're going to continue, you know, with that. There is also another board. It's called CJAB, C-J-A-B, the Criminal Justice Advisory Board. And it is a collection of county agencies that deal with the criminal justice system. So in that CJAB for Monroe County, you have your judges of the Court of Common Pleas, your magisterial district judges, your public defender's office, your correctional facility, the probation office, children and youth, Carbon Monroe Pike Mental Health, Carbon Monroe Pike Drug and Alcohol, and of course the DA's office and all the police departments that service Monroe County, including the Pennsylvania State Police. So I'm very happy to say that I've been elected to be the vice chair of CJAB going forward. I was elected last Thursday along with Judge Stephen Higgins, who is the chair. And we've been in close collaboration and communication on various goals that we want to set for this year Criminal Justice Advisory Board. And I'm also keen on opening up the membership to at least a participation level to all the groups that I've been talking in front of, including your Black Caucus, including the NAACP, including other groups within Monroe County that I think will help create a better atmosphere of cooperation and, more importantly, understanding. Because once we're on the same page to what we can do, what the law gives us as our sphere of influence, I think we can work together to effect change. So look also for the Criminal Justice Advisory Board, or CJAB, becoming more prominent as my first term in office takes off.
Oh, well, you're confident. You already won the election then. what would you say about your opponent?
Well, I mean, no disrespect at all to my opponent, but there's things that aren't waiting for November 7th that require my constant attention every day in my position as first assistant. So I'm setting the table and continuing to set the table as if I'll win in November.
Excellent. And then what would you say? Do you think your opponent is equally qualified? I just want to get a comparison to listeners who may be listening, like, you know what? I think the other guy's better. What would you say, you know, if why makes you the better choice for district attorney?
Well, I'm the only candidate for the office of district attorney that has experience in running a district attorney's office. So when I say running, as second in command, I'm responsible for a lot of the training and the mentoring of the assistant district attorneys. In fact, as part of the hiring process, I require the applicants to participate in mock hearings to see how they react under pressure, what kind of basic knowledge of the rules of evidence and procedure they possess, their ability to think on their feet. I am always on call to answer all their questions, very technical questions, and a lot of them on advising the police what to do, what they can't do, whether to seek a search warrant or whether they need a court order in a given case. whether it should be sealed or not, whether a nighttime search could be requested, whether an anticipatory search warrant can be given. What can you do to determine the location of possible individuals at a certain time? What kind of search warrants can be developed for that? These are things that my opponent has no experience in. My understanding is he has yet to try a criminal case, let alone anything serious in terms of the 50 plus murder trials I've done. Those cases are not easy. There is a lot at stake there. You only get one chance to really do it right as a prosecutor. We don't have, for instance, the right of appeal if there is an acquittal. That's over. So we have to do it right. We have to get it right. And if we believe in a case, and if we believe that there's probable cause to charge a person and to seek a penalty like a lifetime in jail without parole, we better know what we're doing. It isn't the type of job for amateurs and dabblers, people who aren't quite sure what they want to do, who've had a lot of short jobs and haven't shown that that dedication and passion to this job. And I'm the only candidate in the race that has this kind of experience. And again, no disrespect to my opponent. It's just a question of qualifications and being a proven criminal prosecutor on one side and someone who's really yet to establish a record of accomplishment.
Before I close, let me first say thank you for listening, especially those listening for the very first time. I so appreciate you. I appreciate all my listeners, and I hope you enjoyed the discussion. If you wish to provide feedback or comment on any of the episodes, you could reach me at cuckoo4politicsfeedback@gmail.com. Follow me on social media on Facebook. I could be found under cuckoo4politics, or on Instagram, cuckoo_4_politics. I ask that you continue to subscribe to this podcast, which can be listened on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever podcast platform you choose to listen to this episode. Once you subscribe, you'll be able to get the latest episodes that drops, as well as some bonus features. You can also listen to my podcast and find past episodes on my very own website, cuckoo4politics.com. Feel free to comment on either of those platforms, as I welcome all feedback. Now for my closing thoughts. I hope you enjoyed this conversation and got a better perspective of not only about the candidate, Mr. Mike Mancuso, but also how influential the district attorney's office plays in our shared community. Some of the topics discussed during the interview were local, but hopefully you, the listener, who may live outside the Pocono region, got a better understanding of how issues like the additional stress put on our police officers to handle not only a variety of crimes and risk their lives in life-saving situations, but as well as societal woes that's being placed upon them. Given the nature of the job, it's important that intense scrutiny be given to applicants, as like in all professions, not everyone is suited mentally and physically to handle such stressful job environments. Although the burdens put on police is a contributing factor to a decline in recruitment, not only in Monroe County, but across the land, proper training and continued evaluation is warranted as the landscape of crises are constantly evolving. Incentives like good pay and benefits are needed to attract and retain good police officers. The importance of a diverse workforce in private and in public is invaluable, but should not come at the expense of lowering the standards, whereby anybody with a pulse gets to wear a badge. Diminishing law enforcement standards does not bode well for the said applicant or for the institution itself. Mike Mancuso appears to be determined to establish and continue a variety of life-changing programs along with reforms in the DA's office within his jurisdiction. Now, I must be candid with you. My conversation with my guest was very extensive and could not be concluded in one segment. I found him to be very open and found his responses, as a matter of fact, straightforward. It's not to be interpreted as a negative, but just a characteristic of the lawyer in him. We covered a whole host of topics that I must and will share with you in the next episode, including why he recently changed his party affiliation from being a lifetime registered Republican to becoming suddenly a Democrat. Now, the question comes to most voters' minds, especially voters who vote blue, meaning supporting Democratic candidates. Ponder if his switch was a political evolution, or is it a political calculation, given the fact that according to Pennsylvania's election statistics, Monroe County is trending in recent years more Democrat versus Republican. Now, is this a bait and switch move? Stay tuned. Once again, join me in my next conversation as I sit down with First Assistant District Attorney Mike Mancuso as we touch on his political beliefs and other related topics in his campaign as the next district attorney. This is Michael, host of the Cuckoo for Politics podcast. Until the next episode, stay blessed.